It seems to me that the conference has got off to a tremendous start. In the sessions that we've had already, I think they've both helped us to really ponder who the God is who has claimed our lives and how our lives might be lived more to his glory. And I trust this next session will continue that trajectory for us. It's a real pleasure, privilege to welcome David Smith this morning. It was one of my regrets. I had a brief period of time when I was working more actively at International Christian College. It was one of my regrets from that time that I didn't get to spend more time with David and know him better then. But of course, he'll be familiar to most of us. A couple of us in the room were at a paper yesterday where the chair began by saying, "Now, our speaker needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway." And it seems to me that's not a bad idea because we aren't always familiar to each other. But of course, David has for a long time been at the forefront of theological education here in Scotland and beyond, and spent significant time outside this country and on other continents. Spent some time as principal of Northumbria Bible College, but then latterly at ICC, now, as noted, associated with the Center for Ministry Studies at the University of Aberdeen. There's a SETS reading group, small but faithful. We like to think we're faithful. In Edinburgh, and the book that we've been reading just finished last week over the winter has been David Smith's Liberating the Gospel. I can say that we've found it a very stimulating read, and one that if you spent any time with it at all, even reading the blurbs, let alone the glowing reviews that have appeared online, you'll know that it has some significant things to say about the subject that David's going to speak to us about today. So we have these strap lines, doing mission in a globalized age, with this thesis that I don't think we have, that David is responsible for, but in the spirit of a good thesis is willing to engage with and explore. Mission in a globalized age must confront the challenge of the ideology driving change across the world with the faith that the crucified and risen Christ is Lord of all. And we look forward to David's reflections on that thesis now. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much for the welcome and for the privilege of being involved this afternoon. I have to begin with an apology and a little bit of explanation. I was, like Rose, to read a paper, and I started work on that paper quite some time ago, and then knew that I was going to Pakistan and would have 2 weeks when I returned from Pakistan to complete the paper. But unfortunately, I came back from Pakistan 2 weeks ago today, and it quickly became evident that I'd contracted a urinary infection, which really just completely knocked me out. And I sat in front of the computer screen many times trying to bring this paper to a conclusion, and I really couldn't get two coherent thoughts together. So I decided I simply had to abandon the paper. And instead of that, I'm going to offer some reflections on the basis of some notes, literally on the back of an envelope. And these are notes that I made for an address down south in England earlier this year. So it's not unrelated to what would have been the theme this afternoon, which was to have been mission, the future of mission, in a global age. But I'm going to just cover that a little bit more broadly than would have been the case. It's amazing, I think, that more than 25 years after it was published, David Bosch's great book, Transforming Mission, still remains the starting point for any serious discussion of the theology and practice of mission in the 21st century. It's a book that in some ways has now begun to date, but in other ways is still absolutely contemporary and raises the really urgent and significant questions that need to be addressed. I imagine that most of you will know that what Bosch does in this book is to take the concept of paradigm change from the history of science and apply it to the history of Christian mission. So he traces a whole series of major shifts in the theology and practice of mission over Christian history. It illustrates the way in which mission has taken different forms and has often been justified and founded on different types of biblical texts at different points in history. And then he argues, as others have also done, that what is so significant about the time at which he is writing is that we now find ourselves in a phase of Christian history and world history in which we are passing through, or rather we are at the early stages of the latest of these major transitions. And I think Bosch would say it is not just the latest, but also almost certainly the greatest and likely to prove to be the most significant of all. He has a statement in the book which says this: new paradigms of mission take decades, then sharp intake of breath, sometimes even centuries, to develop distinctive contours. The new paradigm is still emerging, and it is not clear which shape it will eventually adopt. For the most part, we are thinking and working in terms of two paradigms. And what he meant, of course, was that we are inevitably, particularly if we are Western Christians, we are inevitably shaped by the past. We received an inherited perception of what mission was and where it is to be done and how it is to be done. And that essentially 19th century concept of mission founded on the Great Commission has profoundly shaped our understanding and our practice of mission. But now there's a new paradigm beginning to emerge, and it overlaps with the one that we've been familiar with. So we're caught between paradigms. And Bosch says this explains why, in many ways, this is a time of uncertainty, and it can also be a time of significant tension between those who are absolutely determined to retain the old paradigm without compromise, mistaking it for something that is universal and applicable in every age, and those who are impatient to discover the new way in which God is working in mission in the 21st century. So it seemed to me that it would be helpful to look back on this book and on that statement I've just quoted and reflect on the extent to which, or if it be the case, the failure of the extent to which, we are now clearer. We're more than a quarter of a century after the publication of this great book. 25 years later, the world has changed in all kinds of significant ways. Some of the ways in which I think Bosch could not have anticipated. So we're now in a different situation. And I think it's certainly time that we ask the question, are we actually becoming clearer? Do we see the path ahead of us in obedience to the mission of God and the call of Jesus Christ with greater clarity in certain respects. And along with that, I think I'm asking the question not just about us as individuals, but about our congregations. Congregations have mission boards, significant amounts of money are directed to overseas missionary work, and there are very significant works being done in the support of missions. But how far has this consciousness that Bosch writes about — few of our congregations will have heard of David Bosch — how far has this consciousness of the shift in a mission paradigm filtered through and affected the way Christians in Scotland today think about mission? I want to risk identifying six areas in which I'm going to ask this question concerning the clarity of our understanding 26, 27 years after David Bosch. The first area that I want to talk about briefly is the area that has always been fundamental to mission, and this is the relationship between the gospel and culture. And it seems to me there are two ways in which culture is particularly significant in relation to this topic. One of these is in the emergence of a global culture, the topic that we should have been looking at this afternoon: future of mission in a globalized age. David Bosch published this book in 1991. He died in tragic circumstances a year later. And in that same year, 1992, Francis Fukuyama, American Asian historian, sociologist, published his well-known and controversial book, The End of History and the Last Man. And the title on its own caused a tremendous discussion, claimed that with the coming of a globalized world, the end of communism and of socialism as a radical alternative of a way of organizing the world, we had reached the terminus point of human history. Sometime later, Fukuyama, reflecting on his title, said the reason he had given it that title was that he believed that free markets and the democratic system that it is assumed is associated with them, more than any other possible way of organizing human society, fulfill the deepest longings of human beings. It's a very significant statement, I think, because it illustrates the way in which he's not just talking about economics. He's advocating a worldview. And within that worldview, there is a particular anthropology, way of understanding what it is to be a human person. And for Fukuyama, what matters is that human longings, in the sense of the desire for betterment, for material things, is the crucial drive, and the free market and the modern economic system can best meet that longing on the part of people everywhere. I don't know whether before he died in a road accident, David Bosch had read any reviews of Fukuyama's book. What is certainly true is that since Bosch's death, that way of understanding the world has spread across the globe so that it is present everywhere. I just come back from Pakistan, so I've spent quite a bit of time in international airports. You don't need very long in the airport at Dubai to see the extent of the spread and the depth of the spread of this ideology. So the whole world is increasingly dominated by this particular culture. And what makes this urgent for us is that at the heart of this culture, there is an untruth, there is a lie concerning human meaning and purpose. There is an ideology that is essentially nihilistic. In the end, it has a belief in nothing except material well-being and betterment. And whatever the future of mission may be, it seems to me that this is going to be one of the two crucial areas. We now have a world church shift in the center of gravity from the global north to the south. We've become familiar with these phrases, and we know the immensity of the growth of the church in many parts of the southern hemisphere. But the challenge for that church is going to be whether it simply goes with the tide of globalization and accepts the globalized vision of the world and its peoples, or whether it becomes so rooted in the alternative vision of the Bible that it will be able to practice a genuinely missionary response to a world in increasing crisis. The other sense in which I want to comment this afternoon briefly on this relationship between the gospel and culture really overlaps with what we were hearing earlier. And this concerns the nature of the church. What difference has the coming of world Christianity really made to Christianity in Europe and in North America? Has it made any difference? Is there actually any visibility in our congregations of the extent of the growth of Christianity in the non-Western world? Increasingly, I think the voices of non-Western Christians demand to be heard, and there are opportunities to hear them. Langham Literature has published a very big catalogue by this time, some of them postgraduate theses, others commentaries on biblical books by non-Western authors. There are tremendous riches in that series. I was looking the other day but a commentary on the Book of Lamentations. Very interesting that Lamentations has languished so long neglected in the Western Church. But in the church in the global South, where suffering is an everyday occurrence and faith exists on the margin of life and death, Lamentations suddenly comes alive. And where Christians find themselves in urban locations that have been devastated, Lamentations speaks very directly into that kind of context. This particular commentary is written by a Filipino, and he writes it in the light of the devastation caused by Typhoon Yolande, which devastated his own city, taking the lives of thousands of people. And so he writes of Lamentations out of experience, because on the basis of his own experience, he can take those words and use them in the way in which they are used in the Old Testament. And many resources like this are becoming available to us. I think it's really important for us to recognize we're an overwhelmingly, if not entirely, white group of people this afternoon. Yet within this city, there are dozens of churches that may be described as ethnic. I interviewed a young woman, a Ghanaian, who's doing a PhD with the University of Edinburgh, and she's exploring church growth in the city of Glasgow. And I asked her how many new churches she had identified, and she said, my period is one decade. So I've just been looking at a 10-year period, and I found 100 new churches. And I said, well, how many of those are ethnic? And the answer is about 95%. So African churches springing up all over the place, but not just African churches. Extraordinary things happening under our noses. An extent of genuine conversions of people who've come out of great distress and are still in great distress. And there may be real difficulties in relating to some of these congregations, perhaps particularly the Nigerians. But we are part of one body in Jesus Christ. And we don't have to think of world Christianity as something distant and remote somewhere in the southern hemisphere, in Asia or Africa or Latin America. It's here on our doorstep. So our mission and our clearer understanding of the emerging paradigm of mission must be shaped and informed by a growing knowledge and fellowship and relationship with people who profess the name of Jesus but come from very different backgrounds to ourselves. I had the great privilege of supervising a PhD by a student from Northeast India. Really, really fine piece of work looking at the problem of identity for Christians in Northeast India. And his last sentence, after about 500 pages, was this: what was once silenced as primitive needs to be given a chance to speak for the good of all. He's talking about a primal society, a traditional society, a people who, in becoming adopted into India and then in becoming Christians, lost their traditional culture. And he doesn't want to revert to that. He's thankful for the gospel. He blesses God for the gift of grace in Jesus Christ. But at the same time, like so many other people across the world, he says, there are some things that were really important that held us together as a people, and we've lost those things. And we need to recover and reaffirm those aspects of our culture. So what was once silenced as primitive needs to be given a chance to speak for the good of all. That brings me to the second area that I want to reflect on briefly. And this is tricky, because it concerns the relationship between the gospel and other faiths. I think it's fair enough to say that the modern paradigm of mission generally assumed the superiority of Christianity as a religion to other religious traditions. I think sometimes that sense of superiority, and this is a controversial statement which you may wish to challenge, but I think sometimes it had more to do with the influence of the theory of evolution than with any foundation in the Bible. I think when Darwin's theory of evolution became applied to historical development and the development of societies and civilizations, some religions ended up at the top. This is where everybody was headed. Others, and particularly primal religions, ended up at the bottom. And so millions of people throughout the world who, for generation after generation, had maintained particular traditions and ways of life, found themselves regarded as sometimes almost subhuman. So there were elements in the modern and most recent model of mission, which I think regarded religions in this way. One of the great passages in Bosch, which has been quoted on numerous occasions, is this. He says, "We have to admit that we do not have all the answers and are prepared to live within the framework of penultimate knowledge. Don't know it all. We only know in part. We regard our involvement in dialogue and mission as an adventure and are prepared to take risks and are anticipating surprises as the Spirit guides us into a fuller understanding. This is not opting for agnosticism, but for humility. It is, however, a bold humility or a humble boldness. We know only in part, but we do know. And we believe that the faith we profess is both true and just and should be proclaimed. We do this, however, not as judges or lawyers, but as witnesses, not as soldiers, but as envoys of peace, not as high-pressure salespersons, but as ambassadors of the servant Lord." One of the beliefs that accompanied this sense of being part of a superior civilization was the belief that it was very likely that at least most of the other religious traditions would disappear. Clearly, that is not the case. And equally clearly, it seems to me, we live in a pluralist world, and there is no indication that that pluralism is going to be reversed. Incidentally, let me just say this. I wanted to give this as an example. I've made a very sweeping statement about convictions held within the modern missionary movement. It's much more complicated than I have suggested. And that's brought home to me by one example that has come to mean a great deal to me. Charlie Andrews was kind of liberal Anglican missionary in India, spent most of his life in India, very close to Gandhi. We remember the Attenborough film on Gandhi. Andrews comes into it fairly early on. But not just to Gandhi, but to a whole raft of very significant Indian leaders. In 1937, he was going to write A Life of Christ, believing that he could do this better in an Eastern setting. And what had inspired him to do this was a letter received from a Hindu friend in India, in which the writer said this: "You know that during the intimate friendship of all these 20 years, I have never asked you anything about Christ, because your own personality has been more than sufficient for me. But now I feel that you must tell me how Christ lived and how he is living in the lives of millions of people. I want you to write in simple English the story of the life of Christ. That is the most important thing you can do." And then this amazing sentence: "You are the only man who can write this book because you have lived like him all these 30 years in India." That's the kind of humility that Bosch is commending. No arrogance, no pride in religion or status, but an absolute trust in Christ and an obedience to Christ. I could give other examples. There's a very remarkable one in this book from the great Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, who spoke at Andrew's funeral and said that the friendship with Andrews was one of the greatest joys of his life. So here's a man who got very close to people who were renowned as Hindu leaders, but who came to respect him because they saw in him something so different. His deep love for India, his profound respect for Indian people, and above all, what they themselves described as the likeness to Jesus Christ. I want to ask a difficult question, and it concerns this still emerging paradigm of mission. How does this work out in practice in relation to other faith traditions? In the past, I think we've always seen conversion as necessarily involving a change of religion. And I want to simply ask the question, I don't have the answer, but I want to ask the question, does that necessarily have to be the case? When I read Acts 15 and the great debate about whether Gentiles need to become Jews in order to be followers of Jesus, that seems to me to be extremely relevant to this issue. Andrew Walls, to whom I owe a huge amount, has made the distinction between conversion and proselytism. And he points out that in the New Testament there is the practice of proselytism. It's done there among the Jews, so Gentiles attracted to the synagogue could become proselytes, went through a long process of initiation, in effect changed their identity to become Jewish. And Andrew Wall says it's remarkable that the apostles with that background rejected that. So that when you come to the book of Acts, they're not making proselytes. And it's one of the great debates in the book of Acts. What they are doing is making converts. And a convert is different from a proselyte. A convert turns toward Christ as Lord and as Supreme, but does so from where they are standing, and then seeks to turn their world. Maybe they and their children after them over a long period of time toward Jesus Christ. Can we envisage the possibility not just of Muslim background believers, but of Muslim believers? In fact, it's not just a possibility, it's been a reality. There was a movement in northern Nigeria before missionaries ever reached Nigeria, in which a very famous Muslim leader in Kano began to notice the significance of Jesus in the Quran, same kind of thing that we're seeing happening today in Muslim cultures. And the more he studied Christ, the more he studied Jesus in the Quran, the more convinced he became that this person was worthy of supreme honor. He was eventually impaled on a stake in Kano Market. But out of his sacrifice and death came a movement of Jesus people, of which there are still traces in northern Nigeria until today. The third area that I want to touch on concerns the relationship between the gospel and mission and the church. Church has always had a central role in mission. On the one hand, it's been the base for mission, and on the other hand, it's been the objective or the goal of mission. So part of mission has always involved church planting, the establishing of groups of disciples who will follow the way of Jesus. But too often in that fading paradigm, denominational patterns and sectional interests sometimes resulted in mission looking not dissimilar to rival and expanding businesses. And over the last few years, I've found myself again and again reflecting on Paul's great vision in Ephesians 2 of the one church in which the dividing wall of hostility is broken down and people from two warring cultural contexts come together, reconciled and healed and united through the cross of Christ. Again, Andrew Walls has written about this in ways that are very, very helpful. And he talks about the Ephesian moment. He says there is this one brief moment in the New Testament where the cross really does its work in breaking down these barriers between human beings and bringing together one body in Christ. And then he comes to the conclusion that where we are today in the 21st century, the opportunity is given for what he calls the return of the Ephesian moment. Only now we have not two cultures in the church, but a whole multitude of cultures. So there's a tremendous opportunity in terms of the witness of the people of God in their very being, in their existence, in their nature, in their relationship and love and fellowship with one another. I want to quote a Catholic theologian in America called William Burroughs. He was the chief editor, commissioning editor of Orbis Books, Catholic publisher, who has done much to publish key works on missionary theology in the last 20, 30 years. And William Burroughs says this: Christian mission is not simply, as Karl Rahner describes it, the overseas marketing arm of European and American churches, seeking to impose the bourgeois morality of the West on people of different cultures. Mission deserves any bad press it gets if it is a mere expression of a church's franchise to another place. The challenge that I'm hinting at here is the challenge of what has been called the discovery of a new kind of Catholicity. And I see in many places a hunger for this. I certainly see it among Roman Catholics who increasingly are rejecting the model of Catholicism from the past, in which everything is dictated from one centre in a way that is authoritarian and overrides cultural freedom. And there are some very significant works written both in Europe and in North America by Catholics who are thinking very seriously about a new type of Catholicity. But I feel the same hunger within myself, feel the same desire that in the kind of world that Rose was describing and the condition of the church which we see all around us at the present time is this longing that we might truly belong together and be seen to belong together as people reconciled and healed and redeemed through the blood of Christ. So very quickly, the fourth point that I want to mention, and this is a slightly odd one and not too well expressed, but it's the relationship between the gospel and people who may be said to shape worldviews and influence ideas and practices. One of the things that we've learned, at least I have learned, from liberation theology is the importance of the poor. And that's a very, very important lesson which underlines a fundamental biblical theme. I mentioned that I was in Pakistan recently and I was taken into the Sindh into a rural area. I had read before I went to Pakistan about this area because I wanted to be prepared and to think, what on earth do I try to say in this situation? And what I had read indicated that many people in the Sindh are terribly oppressed and face the most appalling poverty. And when I arrived where I was staying, in the providence of God, I found myself sitting down with a man opposite me who was a retired college principal. And he began to talk to me about the situation and the way in which low-caste Hindus who were left in Pakistan when partition happened, just as Muslims were left in India by that event. These low-caste Hindus are horribly oppressed by high-caste Hindu landowners. So they are day laborers. It's like rereading the New Testament and hearing the language of Jesus. It's the same kind of economic and social situation. And he told me that often they would labor backbreaking work in the fields, in the heat in Pakistan, and at the end of the day, their wages that would sustain them alive were withheld. And when they had protested, he said recently a group came complaining that they had been very badly beaten. And he told me that he said to them, I'm going to organize a protest march through the town. We have to bring this to public notice and challenge the injustice of those who are so wealthy and possess now almost all of the land. And the people just fell at his feet and pleaded with him not to do that. But if he were to do that, their problems would be enormously increased. Later that day, I was taken to one of these villages and I met the villagers. It's one of the most moving experiences of my life. And as I was leaving the village, having tried to say something to encourage them and prayed for the latest little baby born into that tiny, vulnerable community, the village elder followed me to the vehicle, embraced me and thanked me, shook my hand, and I was aware that he was passing something to me. And when I got inside the vehicle, I found that it was a 100 rupee note. It's not worth a great deal, probably one American dollar, but I shall treasure it forever as an example of the love and kindness of the poor. So that lesson is part of the new paradigm, and it's non-negotiable. It can't be allowed to be removed from our understanding of mission. But I want to ask about other aspects of culture, particularly of Western culture. What about the academics in Glasgow University? What about the artists and musicians, and those who in different ways wield significant influence in our culture? What about architects and urban planners who make a physical difference to where we live and how we live? I've been reading recently a book by James Davison Hunter, To Change the World, with the subtitle The Irony, Tragedy, and Possibility of Christianity in the Late Modern World. It's largely focused on North America. And what Hunter does in this book is to develop a very radical critique of American evangelicalism, both on the political right, but also on the radical political left, and he says that both of them have ended up politicizing the gospel. And as they've done that, in the belief that if they can obtain political power, they can win back the nation, Hunter says First of all, that's not the way culture works. That actually, in the end, will change very little in culture. And then secondly, he says, in the process of taking this path, they have started to reflect the anger and the bitterness and the bigotry that characterizes the wider political scene. And it's a very profound and in some ways very disturbing study of the current situation in the United States of America. But then he goes on to say, right near the end, something very interesting. And I believe he's followed this up with another book in which he develops this theme at greater length. He says, a vision of a new city commons rooted in a theology of faithful presence leads to the repudiation of resentment that defines so much of Christianity's contemporary public witness. It may be that the healthiest course of action for Christians on this count is to be silent for a season and learn how to enact their faith in public through acts of shalom rather than try again to represent it publicly through law, policy, and political mobilization. This would not mean civic privatism, but rather a season to learn how to engage the world in public differently and better. And I love this notion of faithful presence. It seems to me there are many places in culture where that is precisely what is needed by people with the qualifications to do their work well and to be respected in those professions, but to do it in a way that reflects this faithful presence of those who know Christ as Lord, so that they become enigmas, provoking questions. Very briefly, two final areas. The fifth one is the relationship between the gospel and the ecological crisis. When Bosch was writing his book, ecology doesn't feature in it very largely. And certainly during the modern missionary paradigm, it scarcely featured at all. Creation was simply there to be honored, accepted, enjoyed, and to give God thanks for. Clearly, we are living in a desperately different time in the early 21st century. It has changed liberation theology. Leonardo Boff can now write a book with the title Cry of the Earth, Cry of the Poor. In this book, he argues that the two are absolutely interrelated. If we really want to help the poor, we have to respect God's creation and prevent its destruction. Some of you will know that within this city, one of our former students at ICC, Paul Lead, has been involved in some interesting experiments in Possel Park. And one of the things that Paul found in Possel when he arrived there, determined to remain for 10 years with a little community bearing witness in Possel Park, was the extent of brownfield land. That much of the land there contains toxic residues that are the consequence of a post-industrial context. And of course that affects the local community. There are many studies that show that kind of deprivation results in shorter life expectancy and increases in all kinds of illness. And so this little group is concerned to represent Christ, but at the same time ask the question, what do we do about this land? What do we do about God's earth? How can we redeem creation and act in the name of Jesus Christ, not only for the good of the people who live here, that they might hear the gospel, but that the land itself might be renewed and flourish once again? And so Paul writes a book in the Grove book series, Urban Echo Mission, Healing the Land in the Post-Industrial City. And I think increasingly in the emerging paradigm, this will be an aspect of real significance. So that brings me to the final point, which is a rather odd one, and you can tell that this has been put together on the back of an envelope. But it concerns the relationship between the gospel and mission and personal safety. Seems to me that the world in which we're living is a world in which there is increasing levels of danger. And those who are seriously committed to cross-cultural mission have to be realistic and honest about the risks that may be involved. I took with me to Pakistan a book by the writer Pankaj Mishra called Age of Anger, A History of Our Times. And Mishra, in this book and in a number of articles that he's written in the last few years, charts in very chilling detail the rise of extreme anger everywhere, all across the globe. And we don't need to have specific examples. It means that many of our brothers and sisters overseas, where they are Christian minorities in difficult situations, face ever-increasing pressures. So there's a suffering church. But it means, I think, also for us, that as we seek to maintain the links with a world church, and that means not just writing letters to them, but actually meeting with people and encouraging them, there's a measure of risk involved in that. Before I went to Pakistan 2 weeks ago, my wider family, my sister, my brother, pleaded with me not to go. My sister knew that Wednesday before I was leaving, I was going to see my GP, and she said, I hope this is not being recorded and gets back to her. She said, I'm praying your GP will find something wrong with your legs and you won't be able to go. Well, bless her, I love her dearly. I understand her fears and anxiety. Unfortunately, she reads the Daily Mail. So the image that she gets of a Muslim country is inevitably profoundly negative. But there was an element of risk. I arrive in Lahore and find that 3 days earlier there's been a bomb in a restaurant, and among the people killed was a young man of 22 who should have been in my class the following Monday. So the risk is there, but to me, far more important is to meet with brothers and sisters. The number of times people said to me, we are so grateful that you came, because not many people are coming to Pakistan at the moment. And I had that wonderful sense of the unity of the body of Christ. So we're in a dangerous world. In some ways, I think, becoming increasingly dangerous and increasingly difficult. We need to be honest about that, be realistic, and recognize, actually, that's a little bit like more normal mission in apostolic terms. I'm not going to say anything about this book, but I just want to mention it. Alan Lewis, Between the Cross and Resurrection. Fantastic read. Very demanding in places. The subtitle of this book is A Theology of Holy Saturday. And he focuses on the fact that between Good Friday and the death of Christ, and Easter Sunday and the resurrection, there's a Sabbath. And that Sabbath is marked by the apparent death of God. So God incarnate lies in the tomb. And Lewis draws out the theological significance of that Saturday as a core part of the Easter narrative in a way that I've never seen anyone do before. And he relates it to Hiroshima, Chernobyl, and the nuclear explosion. That's Chernobyl. Fukushima in Japan. And in the final chapter of the book, he reveals that as he was writing it, he discovered he'd got terminal cancer. So the final chapter is profoundly moving because he's saying at the end, actually, I found myself now living through my own Holy Saturday. I'm sorry that's got nothing to do with my subject, but I wanted to get a plug in for that book. If you want a really fine theological read, Alan Lewis' book is quite wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you, David. I think one thing we could all say is that must be quite a remarkable envelope that you have there. And we're grateful for the thoughts that you shared with us today, which seem to me not to stray that far from the brief after all. We do have time for questions, and we've got, I think, fairly ample time for the meeting to follow. So if we need a few minutes buffer between the two sessions, we can certainly take that. But are you ready for...
Yeah.
David is happy to take some questions, and we'll get the microphone.
Is that on? Yes, thank you. You mentioned a student studying new churches in this city, and there was about 100 new churches, and they were of different ethnic groups. Just a little question in terms of Ephesians 2, which I think you mentioned, put into practice of barriers being broken down. And I wonder your perception on the extent to which, as churches, we ought to be attempting to cross ethnic divides in practice. And I'm a little bit aware that in a bracket, we've also got theological issues that could separate us. Is it fair to ask, have you any comments to make on that area?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
There are problems, and they exist, I think, on both sides of the relationship. And when I was talking to this girl, I said to her, it was quite clear that her husband is the pastor of a Ghanaian church on the south side of Glasgow, with a very considerable congregation. And the more she described it, the more I recognized it as very distinctively African. And she told me that they had tried to reach out to white congregations in the area to find whether they could have times of worship together. But what became clear was that the worship would be on their terms. Now that's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to experience something that is radically different, but I think a union, a recognition of fellowship that reflects the likeness of Christ will involve more than that. Must involve some degree. I think there needs to be a process of growing understanding. The place to begin, I think, is simply with conversation and getting to know people. But I found in her case, and I found this in other groups as well, that there's a hunger for integration. I think they are aware of the fact that now that they are located in the West, they may have real difficulties down the line in holding on to their own children and their grandchildren, because there comes a point where integration means that those traditions in some respects begin to weaken. So she seemed, and I think this was true of her husband, really desperate to find ways to connect with wider Christianity in Scotland. So, you know, I think you're right. It's not straightforward. It's not easy. There are difficulties along the way. But it can be done.
Just to suggest one way in which this might begin, Andrew Anderson, who's a member of SETS, but unfortunately is not with us this year, he usually is, although he's living now in Oxford. Andrew, when he was in Greenside Church in Edinburgh, had an annual international service to which he invited every ethnic church in Edinburgh to come. And they would come and be part of the program and do their own thing. To some extent, it was, you know, semi-organized. But it was a start, I think, to help the churches in Edinburgh who were represented there, the traditional churches, to get to know these churches. Someone told me the other day that in Edinburgh today there are 20 African churches. Now, I say this as someone who lives in Edinburgh, an elder of a church in Edinburgh. What are we doing to reach out to them? Now, could I ask a question now, having made that statement? And that is that it's very encouraging to see, that, as you mentioned, the growing number of Muslim followers of Jesus. A lot is happening, and we give God thanks for this. But I'm a little bit concerned that many missiologists who are studying this don't seem to mention anything about Ephesians 2. How do you bring, for example, these Muslim followers of Jesus in Egypt, how do you bring them together with the, you know, representatives of the 10 million Christians who are in Egypt? How do they demonstrate their oneness, that they are one body? And do you think this is something we've lost sight of? Is this, if so, how can we re-engage with this issue?
I'm not sure that I'm really competent to answer. I mean, I think this requires somebody with a far greater knowledge of the Islamic context than I possess. I know that in Bangladesh, where there have been very significant numbers of Muslims following Jesus, and large numbers of them seeking baptism, the relationship with the existing church in Bangladesh has been difficult, not least because within that church there is always the suspicion these may not be real converts at all, and if we allow them into our congregation, that may result in great suffering for us. So there's a real deep-rooted suspicion that needs to be overcome in that kind of situation, and I guess it may take quite a time. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. Different versions of the scripture also in Bangladesh, complicating the situation. Mike, do you want to comment?
I think not. Let's
save
the other
question. Okay.
Hello, David. I'm over here. Turn left.
Sorry,
Mike. Hi. Thank you again for your talk. I found it very stimulating and interesting, but I am surprised that you have not mentioned the internet at any time. I've just come back from a conference in Romania, 500 young people there from all over Eastern Europe and Central Asia. I've been teaching medical students for 30 years, For at least 15 years, I have never seen a medical student open a book. All the learning, all their engagement with the world is done on the internet, and yet you've not mentioned it at all in your talk. Now, maybe you felt that was part of the gospel and culture, but I would value your comment.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I think I probably thought 8 points were enough. Of course, you're absolutely right. This is a fundamental part of the culture that is being shaped around us, particularly, as you say, among younger people. And there are huge implications in this. Implications relating to the way in which we communicate. Implications, I think, with regard to what that technology is doing to people, and how it's both changing people and changing human relationships. Absolutely, that would be, if there were more time to discuss this in greater detail, that would be something that would be fundamentally important. I mentioned Pankaj Mishra, The Age of Anger, and he has a really fascinating section in that book about the impact of technology and its relationship to this rising tide of anger. There's much more to say about it, but it wasn't omitted because I don't regard that as important. I think it's fundamental. So thank you for the reminder.
David, thank you very much. It's always wonderful to hear you speak. I just thought I would chip in. One of the great things about this conference is the opportunity to share personal experience. And I was preaching on Sunday in Glasgow Korean Church, and I took along a group of African musicians with me. The Koreans have a great choir, and they spoke to me some months ago about engaging with other ethnic minority churches. I knew them 10 years ago when they were praying for a building. They now have a building, and the wonderful story is that they saw an old church building behind Partick South Church. Partick South is a new build, but behind it are old hall premises. These Koreans were laying hands on it and claiming it for the Lord. The church officer came up and said, "What are you doing?" And they explained. Thankfully, the minister was sensitive to what was going on. He explained the building is not in a good condition, but you can have it on a cheap lease. They've done it up. They use it for their own worship and witness. And one of the things the Koreans do is that every year they have groups of missionaries or young people doing mission trips coming from Korea. And actually, a couple of months ago, I was preaching in Partick South, and they were in the congregation. And I asked some of my friends who are Koreans, what are these missionaries from Korea coming to Glasgow for? He said, they're reaching mainland Chinese. There are thousands of mainland Chinese in Glasgow. Mainland Chinese tend to be fascinated by Korean culture, development, food, religion. And so God is doing wonderful things through ethnic minority churches in Glasgow. I know a wee bit about it. The church I worship in, proud to say, is a church of Scotland that has a majority of Africans in the congregation. And we are learning a lot from one another. Some of them have reservations about the African ethnic churches, which raises other issues about churches becoming mono-ethnic, not necessarily Scottish mono-ethnic, but whether it's Korean or Pakistani or Ghanaian or whatever. But they want to be part of a multi-ethnic congregation. And I think things have changed, not least since David Bosch wrote his book, things have changed even in Glasgow in the last 10 years. I last preached in the Korean church 10 years ago, and I needed an interpreter. This time, they all understood English. I was interested, I was saying to this to David earlier, most of their music was from translations of Victorian revival hymns, and I think that's a problem. I think David over there would agree that was a problem with its dualism. But I think that there's so much going on, and if anyone's interested in contacting some of these groups in Glasgow, do speak to me. Because, I mean, I've got this group of African singers. They come from an organization called Waverley Healthcare, which is an organization supporting people with HIV, Hep C, AIDS. And they go around, they're Christians, they sing in churches, they want to work with our churches and work with our choirs, and there will be blessing in both directions. And I just long that what you've expressed would come true, that we would take time to get to know these groups. I think Rose was saying the same thing. We've got so much to give to each other and so much to learn from each other. Thank you.
I'll just add to that that I think probably most people here are aware of this. Some of the most exciting things are definitely happening with the Iranian community. My friend Wes White, who followed me at ICC, meets in his flat every week with 60 to 70 Iranians, and the thing's just snowballing. Often people in real distress and in very difficult situations, but just praying with fervor, learning of Jesus, coming to Jesus. Wes, being an American Baptist missionary, takes his new converts up to Loch Lomond to baptize them. And he tells this wonderful story of a group baptized, I don't know which month of the year it was, but as one of them came up out of the loch, he said, "This new faith is so cold."
I just about nearly killed an Iranian once in Loch Lomond, early April baptism. Not good. Just to talk a bit more about people from a Muslim background and new groups, and what I've, on a recent visit to Bangladesh, I was encouraged, David, to hear that the traditional Hindu background church is starting to accept the new Muslim background communities because they're recognizing now, after 30 years, an authentic expression of Christian faith, genuine conversion, and starting to ask to learn from their insights and use some of the materials. And we saw a similar dynamic in Turkey, where the first instinct was to put the new Muslim background believers straight into churches of traditional Christian majority, Christian minority background folks, and they died. What then happened was that the new Muslim background groups were given space to grow and develop their own identity. And once they had acquired their own identity and were regarded as equal partners, then there could be a genuine Ephesian moment. But when they were really new, the danger would have been they would just have been submerged. There wouldn't have been space for them to develop their own voice. But with time, I think it's very important thinking about the development of new groups and their identity. They need time, just as we as individuals need time to develop our own Christian identity, so new movements need time to develop an identity. And if you give them time, and that might mean 20 or 30 years, the point will come where they can be a genuine partnership, where both sides are granting each other mutual respect. And then there's an opportunity for learning and enrichment. But if you do it too soon, they're not equal partners.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Well, thank you once again to David for that very rich paper. I mean, I think we've seen this more than once today, that there are papers of very long gestation indeed, perhaps even a lifetime. And it's good to see the intertwining of various lifetimes of experience coming together in this context today. So thank you, David, and thank you those who participated in the discussion as well.